April 23rd. We have everyone but Senator Lincoln and Senator Seekins is in attendance. And we have before us Senate Bill 31. It's about 3:35 in the afternoon. I'd like to do, just so everybody knows, there is a CS that we'd like to adopt, and we have the bill sponsor here to Senator Cowdery, who will give the changes and his staff. And then we have Senate Bill 143, Coastal Management Program. After that, I'd like to get a bite into that. I don't intend to move that bill out today. It's pretty extensive policy change, and it's been the policy of our committee to avoid moving those out in one committee hearing. So, without further ado, Senator Cowdery.
Yeah, I'll have Richard. We've had this bill, and basically I'll have my staff, Richard, explain the changes. Have you adopted the committee substitute?
No. I get a motion for the committee substitute?
Sorry.
Senator Wagner.
Move to adopt CS for Senate Bill number 31, /S.
His motion, is there objection? Object for purposes of just discussion.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a /S in my file.
S. Okay, let's take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Let the record note that Senator Lincoln joined us. Senator Cowdery.
Yeah, I've originally introduced this bill, and it's to establishing a transportation corridor for the extension of the Alaska Railroad to the Canadian border, and eventually hope to connect to the North American Railroad system. And that's the title of the bill, and the amendments that change from the original, it come to my attention that we grant these right-of-ways from DNR to the railroad to do this, and also for pipeline construction, the gas pipeline I'm speaking of. Sometime in the future when that happens, if and when it happens, I wanted to limit the ability of the railroad to establish tariff fees, extra tariff fees on the gas pipeline. Because, you know, the pipeline is, we're trying to put together and cost, everything add to it. Well, I want to do our part in minimizing the cost and not give the railroad the ability to charge tariffs. And that's what these changes reflect. And maybe there's several of them. It's in your packets. And if Richard would like to go through the changes.
For the record, I'm Richard Schmidt, staff for Senator John Cowdery. Since the last time we worked on language changes, the main thing that came to the attention was to make absolutely sure that this bill retains its vision while at the same time not impacting any other vision, which is building the gas pipeline, which would probably logically go in the same area. So folks from the railroad, the Department of Natural Resources, the oil company or the gas line companies, our office, the governor's office, sat down and tried to come up with language that everybody could be happy with. So that's what we have now. And going over from the change, and I don't know, when I am talking about the changes, it's from /Q, which I think was the last one that was up, although I don't know if it was actually adopted. So if you have that copy, that's where the changes are. And I made a printout sort of summarizing the changes. They're really technical in nature. They're just going through the bill and finding places where it might have been a little ambiguous and making them less ambiguous. And we have the Bob Loeffler online and the Alaska Railroad's legal person online, and I would just defer to them to explain the specifics. But I could go through the, there's seven changes, and you have that sheet that I think I handed out, and it shows the changes there. Just adding some words, just to clarify the language. I don't think that they make any real substantive changes. There was no intention to give the railroad, basically the idea is to not have a gas pipeline have to go to two different places to get permits to build a gas pipeline. They just go to the state, and that's the state and the railroad. And that was the main purpose behind it. And I guess the people that are online can answer the specific questions on how that's accomplished.
Okay, we have Bob Loeffler and who is it? The railroad? Bill Johnson?
Bill Johnson, yeah.
We're online. Which one of you wants to run with us?
Mr. Chairman, this is Bob Loeffler. I'm a director of Mr. Money, Land, and Water for DNR. I don't know if you are requesting me to go change by change or just be available for questions.
Why don't you walk us through the changes?
All right. Change number one is in Section A, where we added S3835020. All that does is it make it clear that the corridor may be used for pipeline. Page number two is in Section B. Interested parties. Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yeah, which is loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Change number three is in subsection C, where
we're losing you now.
Okay. Some of the people who read the bill felt that the transportation corridor for the railroad may or may not be consistent with what's needed for a gas line. And both the gas line advocates felt that some agency, and that should be DNR, needs to look at the railroad, look at both the transportation corridor and gas line needs, and make sure it works for both. So there could be with. So it requires DNR to approve the corridor in a way that minimizes impacts on a potential right-of-way for the gas line. Change number four is in paragraph C1. It includes the words "and other provisions of this act," which is a technical change. Change number five is in subsection D.
You might.
Where we add the language "and has identified a funding source for that construction." So the funding source then is the trigger at which, once they've identified a funding source, where we convey management authority. It's just a more explicit trigger than was otherwise within the bill. Change number six is in paragraph D2 and D3. It's really the addition of paragraph D3, and we reserve from the conveyance, this is the most substantive change, if you will. We reserve from the conveyance to the railroad the authority of DNR to manage essentially the gas pipeline. So the identification and management of the gas pipeline remains with DNR, and it is really the fundamental implementation of what Senator Cowdery said. That is, in fact, that the gas pipeline folks then don't have to come to both of us. They, in fact, only come to the Joint Pipeline Office. That change is mirrored in paragraph E2, where the same change occurs. The last change is a rewrite of subsection F, and that just provides protection for the railroad that if, in fact, the Joint Pipeline Office approves a gas pipeline right away, we will consult with the railroad first, and if we need to change the boundaries of a transportation corridor in order to accommodate the best interests of the state, it gives DNR the authority to do that. Those are the eight changes made in what I don't have your committee substitute in front of me, but those are the eight changes that I understand are made.
Okay. Senator Elson has a question.
Actually, not a question. I wanted to take this opportunity. Bob, I really appreciated your quick response to the question that I had, and I think that Senator Ogun had on subsection F. I mean, I was very surprised at how quickly you responded, and the change that you've made in that subsection, I think, adequately addressed the concerns that I had, and I just wanted to thank you.
You're very welcome.
I have a question. This bill seems to be silent on, like, tariffs that the railroad could possibly charge the gas pipeline for either crossing or using the right-of-way. Is there something we need to do there?
Because we are reserved, because the changes reserve from what is conveyed to the railroad the right to authorize a gas pipeline right-of-way, then the railroad does not play in tariffs or other gas pipeline decisions, except, of course, that we would have to coordinate with them if a railroad existed there. They would be experts on railroad safety standards.
Okay, so we've got that covered then.
I believe so, Senator. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cowdery has a question.
Yeah, in the event the railroad is in and the pipeline comes along and decides to cross, has a need to cross the railroad right away, just to cross it. Is that covered in here?
I believe so, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cowdery. I believe it is, that the decision to cross it would in fact be DNR's decision, of course, because of applicable federal and other safety standards. We couldn't cross it in a way that didn't respect those safety standards.
I think it would be reasonable that if it did have to cross, it'd have to do it to the satisfaction of the railroad for the integrity of the railroad, but the fees incurred in doing that would have to be borne by the pipeline, I'm sure, but I just didn't want them to say, well, so much a cubic foot of gas or any kind of a tariff bill into that.
The pipeline does not, the railroad would not get to add additional, under this, the way I understand it's written now, Senator, Mr. Chairman, the gas pipeline would not, or the railroad would not be able to add to the tariff or decide the tariff on the portion of land, on the portion of its route through the railroad corridor. I don't think it's explicit in the bill that the railroad would have to establish particular safety standards, but I think it's explicit in the way, it's implicit, I believe, in the way government works, whether you want to.
So I just wanted that kind of on record what the intent was here.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Does anybody else have any questions? Senator Lincoln.
I'm still struggling with, on page 4, starts with line 29, if a railroad improvement has not been constructed on a segment of the transportation corridor. I guess my question is, if the railroad comes in, if I'm reading this correct, excuse me, if a railroad has started their process before the gas line corridor, then and the department finds they need that portion, then they have then what happens? I mean, the department can just automatically adjust the location of the transportation corridor? I'm confused with that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lincoln, is that question addressed to me?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. If the railroad is, so, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lincoln, your question is if the railroad is already built?
That's right.
If the railroad is already built, then they are conveyed the land. DNR reserves out of the conveyance, so they own the land, and like private landowners, one has to deal with them before crossing their land. except for the following. We are not conveying them the oil and gas mineral rights. We're not conveying them the right to get people across it, because that's still remaining with DNR. And we're not conveying them, and we're reserving to DNR the right to authorize a gas pipeline. So it would be still, it would be as if you owned the land, but DNR, you didn't own all of it. DNR still owned the right to authorize a gas pipeline to cross your land. And that's the situation the railroad would find itself in. Of course, because there's a railroad, you can't just, they, I assume, would have, we'd have to consult with them, and in fact, we would have to meet applicable safety standards and things of that nature. I mean, federal law won't allow you to do certain things to your railroad. So that consultation would have to occur, and those changes in the railroad, I'm sure, would have to occur, and that those would be under the jurisdiction of the railroad. Did that answer your question, Senator?
It does. I still have some concern about that, but it answers it.
Does anyone else have questions? Hearing none. We also have Phyllis Johnson. And Phyllis, are you with the railroad?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am. I'm the general counsel of the railroad, and I also have Jeanette James here with me as well, listening in and ready to offer commentary if you like.
Do you concur with the analysis that Mr. Leffler gave us?
Yes, sir. I think you ran through the changes pretty succinctly and correctly. There was one change that's not so much from added language as just moving things around that might need to be at least touched on, which is that even after the everything's built, you know, the railroad and the pipeline, you know, if all the stars line up correctly here, as Mr. Leffler mentioned, the Department of Natural Resources retains the authority to manage and deal with the pipeline people entirely. And I think that's good and appropriate, because it wouldn't be fair for them to have to deal with several different outfits for one, you know, entire pipeline. So that's great. I think in an earlier version of this, when it was more generic, at least certainly after the final transfer of the 200-foot corridor, the final corridor to the railroad, then if there were existing contracts which could have included a pipeline contract, DNR would have prorated, and even though DNR charged whatever the charge was for the lineal footage on railroad right-of-way, they would have split a proportion off and just paid over to us. So the pipeline people wouldn't have to deal with the railroad, but railroad would get a small percentage based on how much of the pipeline was in the railroad corridor. And I think that's changed a little bit here. Mr. Leffler can correct me if that's not right, but I think for the pipeline, all the revenues would stay with the DNR operation rather than prorate with us.
Okay. Any questions of Phyllis Johnson? Hearing none.
Senator Olkin, this is Jeanette James. Could I make a few comments?
Sure, Jeanette.
First of all, I'm representing the governor's office in a way here. I'm the railroad advisor to the governor. I've talked to all the parties on this issue, and here's my concern. And it's not a concern of the gas line folks, and it's not a concern really of the railroad folks, but it's the reality issue of this. And you have to think about this to see whether or not, which comes first, the railroad or the gas line. And I think we'll all agree that we want both. Maybe some people don't want one or the other, but I think we do here anyway. And we want the effort to get these two corridor issues without conflict and without competition, but to be complementary in both sides. My concern is that when all is said and done, any portion of the gas line that is included in the railroad's property, the revenues from that should be prorated to the railroad. And for the exposure that they have by having that gas line under their property. I've talked with the gas line folks, and they don't have any problem with that. They agree that it wouldn't affect them at all, as long as the tariff, whatever their fees are, has already been established by DNR, and the railroad doesn't come along and charge them more. And of course, the state, the concern was, well, how do we do this? Well, you know, as an accountant, it's not difficult. The gas line folks just pay the state, and there's a calculated amount that then gets transferred to the railroad for any exposure they have for that gas line being in their right-of-way. I think there is, if that is not the way it is, there may be some conflict at some later time that we don't want to have happen. And so that's my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions on that issue. I think that in this drafting of this substitute here, and which was Bob Leffler said, you know, he was trying to do the drafting that met everybody's concerns. I think that wasn't sufficiently discussed at that time. And I've been, ever since I got the copy of it, have been working on this issue to see if there's any objection to that. And I found none. I talked to Mark Wister today. I wasn't able to get Sean Parnell on the phone. And as long as they're not interfered with in the process, they have no problem with this. And I would hope that we would allow the railroad to have the revenues for those uses that are within their corridor, even though they may not have established the rationale or the money for it, that once it is transferred to them, assuming that they are after the gas line, that the revenues would inure to the railroad.
Thank you, Jeanette. Senator Lincoln, I have a question.
First, I didn't quite hear, Jeanette, you said you're a consultant to the governor on the railroad?
That's correct. My title is railroad advisor to the governor.
So that's a paid position?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I wanted, if Jeanette could again explain, because that was the concern that I had in questioning that one section about who really has the ownership then for the gas line. I'm not so concerned about whether it's before the railroad is built or after the railroad is built, but when Jeanette talks about prorating to the railroad, that there's exposure to the railroad for the pipeline within the corridor, I have some concerns about that, and maybe I misunderstood her. If she could clarify that for me.
Ms. James? We have to just kind of guess at what kinds of situations there could be on the ground, Senator Lincoln. I'm just using the evaluation of there was a gas line identified previously when they were talking about it, and they came to my office as majority leader, and there was one place where the gas line crossed the existing railroad corridor that is identified on the map. That railroad corridor is probably in the neighborhood of where a new railroad corridor would be, and maybe not, because that's yet to be determined and surveyed and a feasibility study done, and lots of things that identify that. And it seems to me that when both the railroad and the gas line are going to be going down the Alaska Highway area to someplace in Canada, that certainly there is a possibility that they might be in very close proximity. There is, if you have a piece of land and a gas line is going through your land, there is an exposure there. And so it doesn't seem reasonable. And no matter what the amount of compensation is, that if there is any compensation being paid for that gas line, that the exposure should go to the landowner. And that's my issue. There may be none, except maybe a cross here and there, or there may be a lot that is lined up simply because the gas line is where the railroad needs to go because of the topography and geological situations there. But generally, I would think the gas line would be away from there because they can go over hills and valleys and different things that the railroad can't. We don't know what those things are. But it just seems to me that the issue of the money that has been contracted to be paid by the gas line people to DNR for this right-of-way, and I have no idea what that will be, not involved in determining what that is, any portions of that that ends up being in the railroad right-of-way ought to be transferred to the railroad. Even though the management of the gas line stays with DNR.
So do you have, like, suggested language changes?
I haven't done that. I certainly can do that.
And Mr. Chairman, this is Phyllis Johnson. I could chip in and say we saw this draft, you know, recently enough that we didn't have a chance to work up some additional language to accomplish that, but we could certainly do so pretty shortly and make it available. I apologize for not having done that in advance.
All right, well, any other questions, Senator Elton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative James. I'd like to help you, I guess, define the boundaries for me a little bit. When you say compensated for any exposure by the railroad, I mean, you're talking about risk. You're only talking about compensation for risk. You're not talking about compensation to the extent, for example, that the railroad gets for laying fiber optic cable in the transportation corridor, are you?
No, Senator Elkin, I'm not assuming or suggesting that the railroad should make any charges other to the Capline people other than those that have been arranged by DNR. It's no extra money or anything. It's just that when the railroad, if that goes throughout the railroad corridor, that as any other landowner, they should get the revenues for that land lease, whatever that happens to be. Certainly not suggesting they add anything more to it or get any longitudinal amount, but that they should be able to get whatever the portion is that was determined by DNR that they would be paying to the state for this right of way.
The comment, and I mean, first of all, Representative James, I want to say I appreciate all the work you've done. I know that you carried legislation very similar to this in the past, and you probably know much more about it than I. But I mean, the kind of the flip side of that argument would be to identify a gas pipeline right of way, and have them charge the railroad if the railroad wants to cross a gas line corridor.
Well, you could say that's the flip side of that, but they're two entirely different sorts of transportation systems. And certainly this bill, what it does specifically, Senator Elkin, is to give the land the simple title to the railroad where their corridor is. That, I assume, is a 200-foot-wide corridor in most places within a 500-foot transportation corridor. And there's lots of reasons for, in fact, is historically railroads have owned the land that they run on, and that's a typical way that railroads work. It is not typical for gas lines to own the land that they are on or under.
Okay, let the record reflect Senator Seekins joined us. Any other questions? Senator Lincoln.
Well,
maybe just for housekeeping here, we're kind of straying a little bit from right now. There's a motion to accept the CS. I objected, so we're talking about the CS. I think we're straying into other areas beyond the CS.
I'm speaking to the CS, and as I look at the CS here, it says very specifically that it's for 500 foot wide, except where, and you know, not 200. That I hope I have the right CS.
Yeah. /S is in Sierra.
It's 500 feet, and I'm bothered by you know, the whole idea, Mr. Chairman, for the the legislation is to get a railroad connecting from Alaska to Canada. That was the impetus for this piece of legislation. And I get really bothered when I hear discussion about, well, you know, we need to start paying for the right-of-way, paying the Alaska Railroad for any right-of-way. That's not what this bill was all about. So I have problems with it being still this 500 foot, which is maybe more into the real estate side of it than it is for the goal of getting the railroad tie extended into Canada.
Mr. Chairman, this is Phyllis Johnson with the railroad. May I answer part of that, please?
Sure,
please do.
Okay, the introductory part of the statute to which Senator Lincoln is referring does say 500 feet, and it does say exactly 500 feet. However, when you get down to the point of actually constructing a railroad, I would refer you on over to, at least on my copy, it starts on the bottom of page 3, it's section E. And then if you read on further there in the subsections, once the railroad construction is completed, the railroad does an as-built survey, basically, and the conveyance to the railroad then from DNR is only 100 feet either side of center line. So the intent here was to kind of reserve a whole 500-foot corridor that's big enough for a lot of purposes, and then once the railroad gets itself settled down, we only get our usual 200 feet that may wind around within that 500 feet altogether. So it leaves the other 300 feet within DNR's jurisdiction as a transportation corridor.
And I would assume that you would, Ms. Johnson, that you would work out any conflicts as far as placement of the railroad and the pipeline. In fact, that's what I think some of the amendments do. Isn't that correct?
Yes, sir. I thought those amendments were very good, especially in kind of adding the requirement for the railroad to consult with other parties early on in our decision making as to where we thought this should go, and then kind of making DNR the arbiter amongst us all as to what the final location should be after consultation with all the other interested parties.
Okay. Is there anybody else? Well, I want to remove my objection for the, I think we had a pretty good discussion with CS does. I'm going to remove my objection adopting the CS. So if there's no other objection, we'll adopt the CS. Okay, let's see. I think we have some other people that would like to testify since there's no other questions of Ms. Johnson and Mr. Leffler. We have a somewhat limited time schedule. We've gone actually a lot longer on this than I anticipated, and we still have to cover the coastal zone management. So I'd like to limit the testimony necessary. I'm not going to put a specific time limit on it, but if it goes on too long, I'm going to ask people to wrap up. But we only have two, so let's see. Can't read the writing. Char? Let's see.
Charles.
Yeah, Charles Juarez. Charles, sorry. Come on up, Charles. And you're with the Trans Yukon Railway, huh? All right.
My name is Dr. Charles Juarez, J-U-R-A-S-Z. I'll wear two hats with you this afternoon. One as a one of 16 members of the rail infrastructure in Canada with Canada West Foundation, and one as the vice president of Ferro Sustainable Development Corporation, whose major task is to establish a Trans-Yukon Railway. I'm here to address some concerns that have been pronounced about two things: the level of interest that exists in Yukon for this effort, and secondly, the amount of interest and engagement that exists on the national level with Canada and on the territorial level with Canada. In terms of the interest level, 1 month ago, a survey was carried out by DataPath Systems in Whitehorse addressing the issue of awareness of a Trans Yukon Railway or the rail link and a support statement. And I'll give you the explicit numbers. 68% of those people polled, both within Whitehorse, that represents basically two-thirds of the population of the territory, 68% of those folks in Whitehorse were aware. And 66% of those folks in rural Yukon were aware. Of those who were aware, 90% supported. And the breakdowns were done on the basis of gender and age. And even the range is important for you to be aware of, which is that the lowest support level was 84%, and the highest was 98%. So we are aware, and we are supportive. Secondly, we went from a position in the Yukon of barely having this of any interest in terms of being on our map to one which now watches very, very carefully the method by which you are proceeding, because you have led since 1979. Your method of approach is very, very important to us. We have seen the potential success for this being based on a railroad first assisting a pipeline. The intent there was to respond to early interests by pipeline people in the reduction of cost in establishing that line. And that's the method by which we approach this. As recently as 10 days ago, one of the key gentlemen responsible for making that decision as to whether or not we have a bilateral commission agreement on the Canadian side, we had the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Bill Graham, come to Whitehorse. He sat down with five of us, including the Premier's office, and we discussed this. And at the end of those meetings, and as he said, this is less than 10 days ago, by evening time, 11 o'clock at night to be explicit, there was conversation between our Premier, Dennis Fenty, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Bill Graham, addressing candidacy for that commission. So I think that the level of support that you were hoping for is there, albeit it's not always as enthusiastically presented.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions? Senator Lincoln.
Just one. When you had the breakdown of the poll that you took, being Whitehorse versus rural, what is the breakdown of the support between those two?
The support in Whitehorse was 68%. The support in the rural communities was 66%. The organization that was responsible is called DataPath Systems in Whitehorse, DataPath Systems.
How many households did you poll?
I don't know the raw numbers. But when I asked the question, I called them approximately 2 hours before appearing before you. They said it was one of our fuller, meaning more people were spoken to. So I can't give you the raw numbers. I can simply tell you that they were confident this was one of their better polls in terms of representation.
Perhaps you could send that to us.
I would be delighted.
It's available.
Surely.
Anything else? Senator Elton?
Mr. Chair, this is kind of an embarrassing question. Do you have a third hat as a retired teacher?
Oh, for goodness sakes.
I would just like to point out that when he was a teacher in our school district, I think you went more by Chuck than Charles, and he is one of the people that is very responsible for a lot of our younger people's interest in the biological sciences. He was one of our outstanding teachers here in Juneau before he adopted the other two hats.
Thank you for the record. Senator Wagner.
I just have a kind of a generic question on financing, ownership, and everything on the Yukon side of this. Would this be the Yukon territory? Would this be private corporation funds to build the intertying section? What do you foresee of that?
You have identified options that we are addressing right now. First of all, the route that would be chosen for the rail and the pipeline are certainly well established on your side. If you were to ask what routes do we look at on the Yukon side, we have a map that shows the interests of rail in the Yukon. And they are certainly absolutely consistent with what you're interested in for the pipeline. But there are many additional items because much as the initiating legislation, the concern was rails to resources on the Alaskan side. In order for us to handle rails to resources on the Yukon side, we're looking at corridors that are not coincident with anything that you're addressing currently for pipeline. When you ask at what level are we looking to, or what are the different sources for funding, etc., there is no question that private ownership becomes very significant to us, i.e., that much of the rail interest lies within the private sector. We have some advantages on the Canadian side. There are organizations that literally sponsor us, ensuring both public and private partnership. So we have, for example, a Canadian Council for Private and Public Partnerships, which pursue only mega projects, and the railroad across the Yukon would be such a project.
Thank you. We're going to have to move along here. We're really running behind schedule, but go ahead, Senator Dicey.
Thank you, sir, for your helping on this project. I think it's been almost a month since I was on Whitehorse. Is there any new signals from the Canadian federal government about the bilateral commission on the railroad?
The most significant was the one that I identified with Bill Graham because that was so current. And the reason that Bill Graham was identified as perhaps higher on the totem pole for decision-making than was recognized before was because Department of Transport recognizes this as an international potential project, and therefore foreign affairs is going to carry a stronger weight than it did before. So the significance of Bill Graham sitting down with our Premier, Dennis Fenty, and discussing membership, literally those individuals who would be involved, I consider to be a very positive statement.
Thank you.
I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, and I certainly will make myself available as you requested.
Thank you. Next we have Jack Phelps. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
First time you testified in this committee?
It's been a while.
It's your new job.
That's right. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jack Phelps. I'm a special assistant to the Governor for Natural Resources and Transportation. And I just wanted to make it clear that the Governor's commitment to seeing a rail link between Alaska and the rest of the world through Canada is of longstanding and is well known. When he was in the United States Senate, he's the one who formulated the bill that would have created the bilateral commission, and I handled those issues for him in the United States Senate. He is very interested in seeing that rail link developed, and he's also very interested in seeing that corridor set up so that it's useful for other matters, pipelines, fiber optic linkage, whatever is appropriate. And he has long felt that there was a value in having a corridor that was for multi-purpose. But very obviously, the first piece of that is related to this piece of legislation. Now, the CS that you have before you, the Udom World Draft of 423, is a direct result of carefully worked out discussions between Senator Cowdery's office and our Department of Natural Resources. And the administration's position is that this is a good bill. That's not to say there might not be other issues that might be addressed as time moves along, but we are supportive of what Senator Cowdery has developed here.
If the administration wants to see the bill move today?
We would be supportive of that.
All right, anything else, Senator Lincoln?
Mr. Chairman, were you here, Jack, when Jeanette James testified?
Senator Lincoln, through the chair, yes, I was.
There was one potential amendment that she was speaking of. Could that possibly be one of the, quote, other issues that may be developed?
Senator Lincoln, through the chair, that is certainly one that can be discussed. At this point, I'm not prepared to, you know, to discuss the details of it, except to say that there are complexities related to it. But I think the short answer to your question is yes.
Senator Seekins? Oh, you're just...
If I understood your question to be, is it one that is a potential? That was... Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Phelps. And last but not least, we have Dana Olson and Matt Sue would like to testify.
Thank you very much. I came into the Legislative Information Office and was shocked to find that this bill could affect me. And so I'm not really prepared to testify today, but I've been venting down here. One of the big problems I have with this bill is notice. You know, I have a property interest where I have a reservation for a federal railroad on a federal patent. And I have had assurances from the Alaska Railroad that by the end of March I was going to get a response. Of course, I didn't get the response, and here I find out there's been a bill and been coordination among various people. But the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act of 1982 on January 5th of this year, 2003, said if there was 18 years of non-continuous use that it reverted back to the federal government and would be published in the Federal Register. It requires the governor or the Secretary of Transportation or the Secretary of Agriculture. It requires a multiple effort to give the notice of who might be affected. This bill doesn't even exist. So in other words, I'm sitting here being asked to testify, and I don't even know if I'm affected. One of the problems I find with this bill is that it violates the Federally Aided Highway Act. Railroads are highways. You say 500 feet, my lot's 330 feet, and I'm on the high ground. It would be probably within anticipation that probably would be on my property. I also met with DNR a while back ago about hearing that in a industry thing at the Sullivan Arena that a pipeline was proposed to go across the inlet, and that the legal description was within the 640 acres of supposed right-of-way here. And so I'm very concerned about this bill.
Dana, excuse me, but you live in Matsu, right?
I do.
And this pipeline corridor is between Fairbanks and Canada.
The only trouble is that the pipeline is expected to have spurs, and so it becomes one. Whether you implement it in little pieces, it doesn't matter, because it affects me indirectly or directly.
Okay,
but the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act requires that that notice be published, and I've been down to the governor's office and asked for a meeting with the governor's aides or persons, and I've been denied that. So I have a problem with this bill not giving a notice to affected persons, and then not defining who is affected. Obviously, you can't legislate until you know who's affected. And to write a bill in this fashion about pipelines and about the railroad seems to be inconsistent with two different topics here being interjointly done together. So I'm going to have to request that the Alaska Railroad immediately provide me the request that they put in writing to me that they would answer by the end of March, and they have not done it. Thank you very much, and I would ask that this bill be stayed until some appropriate notice has been given out for persons to appropriately testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dana. Well, just for the record, the appropriate notices have been given on the bill, and that's why you're here to testify, I assume. And, just wanted to point out that this bill deals with a railroad, Alaska Railroad to Canada, an extension of the Alaska Rail to connect the North American Railroad System. So this is between Fairbanks and Canada, and really does not affect Mat-Su, other than if we get this, maybe we'll have some better economic opportunities there. So anyway, just so you know, thank you for testifying. I'll close public testimony at this point unless there's somebody else that has testified or wants to testify that that is on the teleconference network. Hearing none, is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify? Any other questions of the bill sponsor? What's the wishes of the committee? Senator Wagner.
I'd move CS for Senate Bill number 31/S with individual recommendations and fiscal note.
Object for a question.
There's an objection by Senator Elson.
I guess the only concern that I've got with moving the bill is it sounds to me as if there is a fairly substantive amendment that's being prepared that talks about compensation to the railroad from the gas pipeline people. It would seem to me that this would be the appropriate committee for review of a change of that magnitude. And so my concern is that we let this bill go if that and it sounds to me also as if, because of the testimony of Mr. Phelps, there might be an interest in the governor's office in seeing that amendment added. My concern is that if we let it go out of here, we're not going to have any opportunity to review the question. And for me, this is a big question. I mean, what has primacy here and how we handle the natural gas pipeline seems to be an issue that we all need to consider very carefully. And I'm not saying this to slow it down. It just seems to me that if, in fact, some people are suggesting they want to amend it, it ought to be amended here.
Well, just for the record, this bill does have a finance committee referral, even though it doesn't have a fiscal note. I find it interesting. So, get another bite of the apple up there and then bite the apple on the floor.
Mr. Chairman, my short response to that is, and I appreciate that, and I know it has another committee referral. I think we're asking an awful lot of our finance committee people to start getting involved in issues that go far beyond a fiscal note or fiscal impact. That's a substantive policy decision that we're passing off.
I hear your concerns, and I don't think there's a consensus out of the governor's office that there's a problem. And I'll give my word that I'll you track that, and it's a serious problem, and let's address it. Senator Lincoln?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to echo my concerns about it leaving the committee. I know that as a chair you've been very thorough with all of the bills that have been before us, and I appreciate that. But I want to echo the very concerns that has been expressed from the senator to my right. But I don't view that as a Finance Committee's obligation to deal with resources, and we don't know what the amendment that Jeanette James was speaking of. I'm assuming that since she is the railroad advisor to the governor, that she is working with the governor on this. And for her to say that she's got, you know, an amendment, a possible amendment that is resource related, I think it should be dealt with here in this committee and not moved on, and to suggest that we can amend it on the floor is not that easy, as you well know. So I don't think that we've done everything here on this committee to finalize this.
Well, I understand where you're coming from, and the testimony of Ms. Johnson clarified it for me that with the, there's a 200-foot right-of-way that will end up being deeded 100 foot of each side of the center line, and that DNR is the arbitrator of those conflicts, and that's what set my concerns aside, gave me enough comfort to move this out, with all due respect. So, Senator Bryson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to see this thing move too, and I think that we have a marvelous opportunity here, and slowly but surely, the forces of everybody recognizing certainly for our state, and I can certainly tell you it was strongly reflected when a month ago when I was in Yukon, that getting the economy moving and jobs for people is a very high priority for both governments. And I believe that the gentleman that spoke here, formerly from Yukon, or from Juneau, is exactly right. There's a change in the federal government's attitude in Canada. And so I think we have an opportunity here that for everybody to come together. And I can tell you that, and there wasn't really any testimony here, but for the interior of Alaska and for Yukon, there's an immense amount of mineral wealth north of the highway that both sides of the border are very, very eager to have commercialized. And the thing that keeps it from happening is getting it to market. And I believe that the issues of what the railroad will charge for people using the corridor or crossing the corridor can be resolved as this process goes forward. And we've got a month until the session's over, and I would encourage us to keep this vehicle, which is a small part but a very essential part of getting this project happening, that we keep this vehicle moving. And thank you. That was a vote for moving.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to maintain my objection, but I do want to say, as this bill is written, I have absolutely no problem with it. And I want the sponsor to know that, and I want, you know, everybody else to know that. I mean, the question that remains in my mind is that if, when we're talking about economic development, I agree with the senator who just spoke. I mean, very, very important. But when we talk about, a suggestion that may happen in the future that allows the railroad corporation to do a charge off against the gas pipeline, I'm going to tell everybody right here, if I have to pick, primacy is going to be given to the pipeline from me. And it just seems to me that what we're doing is we're just assuming that there's not going to be anything that gets in the way of the gas pipeline. I hope that's the case. I love this bill. Well, love is a strong word. If my wife heard me using the word in that context, she would object. And so I pull that back. This is a good bill. I have absolutely no problems with it. The only problem I've got is if there's an amendment coming forward that even suggests that there may be a charge off to the gas pipeline, I want it reviewed here, because the gas pipeline is my number one priority.
Okay, well, again, I just have to restate for the record, I think there's some ambiguity from the governor's office that needs to be worked out, I think. It wasn't ambiguous from Mr. Phelps, but we had another person claiming to be representing the governor's office that was a little bit of difference in. So let the record reflect I share your concerns, and that's not the intent of this legislation. And I think the intent of this committee that is to give the pipeline the privacy. So whether or not that needs further language, you know, if it was 2 weeks ago, I'd say, yeah, let's hold it and work on it. The time, the clock is ticking here. So I'm willing to trust, you know, I'll have some conversations with the administration, and I'm willing to, there's a level of trust I think I have with the administration to work on it, so I won't object to move it out. Does anybody else want to say anything? Nothing? Okay. Somebody want to take the roll?
Senator Lincoln?
No.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Benson?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator
Wagner?
Yes.
Senator Elkin?
No.
Yes. So the yeas have it, and the bill moves.
Calgary, yes.
And we're going to take a...
Calgary says yes.
A few minute at ease here.
Thank you.
And I really thought we had all the problems worked out in the last bill and didn't anticipate the level of discussion that we had. And boy, we got pages of people here to testify.
I'm leaving at 5.
So I don't intend to move the bill out today. And if we don't get to everyone that's signed up, I will apologize in advance. I think what we'd like to do, out of respect for people that take time off from work and show up and want to testify on these things, if we could have a very brief overview of what the bill does, maybe we can have a little bit. There is a CS that I would like to put on the table. It's work draft
06069,
Bill 3.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, and I appreciate the way you're handling this. I'll move the work draft for you if you want.
Okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, would just like to say that two of us have a conflict, a caucus conflict, and we'll need to leave at 5. And so I'm assuming that when it comes back up at the next meeting, that there will be DGC, DNR people here to answer questions that we might have.
Yeah, they will be, and they get paid to do this, and they can come back, and the people that are out there that are taking time off from work and being good citizens is who I want to give priority to.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dyson.
Respectfully, I think it's unfortunate to schedule meetings during a time that standing committees are scheduled to meet. This is the second time it's happened in 2 days, you know, and when people come from all over the country and we have our scheduled bills, and particularly substantive ones, I just encourage everybody to not schedule another meeting during that time out of respect for the process and people that have flown in and driven some distance and stuff to be able to testify. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe let's not get into a protracted debate about that, okay?
Yep.
Thank you. Your point's noted. There are people that did fly in. I think I want to give priority to the people that flew to Juneau today to testify on this. If there's somebody that flew in and is not going to be available, we will be hearing this bill again Friday. Is there someone here in the audience that fits that category? Seeing none. Raise your hand, speak now, or forever hold your peace. Okay, we have one.
Hear more?
Okay, we have two.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
My name is Marty Rutherford, and I'm here today to represent the Department of Natural Resources and the administration and speak to the committee substitute for Senate Bill 143, which you've just moved under for consideration. I would like to note for the record that I am under contract to the Department of Natural Resources. I recently left DNR after about 11 years, mostly serving during that time as DNR's deputy commissioner. And I do have several people with me today that I'd like to introduce, not that they're going to give testimony, but just so you know who they are. Mr. Breck Tostevin with the Department of the Law. who's been the attorney on this bill, Mr. Pat Galvin, with DNR's Division of Oil and Gas, but he is also the past director of DGC, which was the organization that housed the Coastal Management Program until a week ago, and Mr. Randy Bates, who's employed as the newly appointed Coastal Program Coordinator with the Coastal Management Program, which is now part of DNR's Project Management and Permitting Office. This is the team that has reworked SB 143, that has made very substantive changes to the bill in response to comments that that the administration received while its sister bill, House Bill 191, was under review in the House. I'd like to note that you have in front of you, I hope Linda handed them out, some materials in addition to the committee substitute to the Senate Bill 143. You have a brief one-page synopsis of the substitute we'll be discussing today. You have a timeline that identifies milestones in the transition from the old to the new program. You have a chart that compares this committee substitute to the existing Coastal Management Program, and you have a sectional analysis of the committee substitute. And Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do with your approval is to provide an overview of the primary elements of the committee substitute. I was going to then have Rec Tostevin walk you briefly through the bill's sectional analysis, dealing only with the highlights, but since you're short of time, I think we can waive that since it is in writing.
And just for the record, there was a motion to accept the substitute. I heard no objection, so we'll consider the substitute before us. And also, the Senate President has joined us, and you're welcome to join us at the table or sit wherever you like. But thank you for your interest in the issue. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you are undoubtedly aware, the Coastal Management Program is an older program that hasn't, in my opinion at least, appropriately responded to Alaska's maturing statutory and regulatory regime. Therefore, frankly, the program is often redundant. It uses local enforceable policies that are often a reiteration of existing regulatory agencies' permit standards. And the program is also unpredictable. It's overly broad in scope. It takes too much time, and it delays the issuance of permits and startup of projects. And frankly, the statewide standards and the local enforceable policies are vague, and they're extremely subject to multiple interpretations. However, sure, absolutely.
Don't you notice she's hiding behind somebody? Representative Cotullo is here as well. Okay. Thank you. Sorry for interrupting.
No, that's okay. However, while the program has problems, frankly, the very sweeping changes that were embedded in the original SB 143, which eliminated many of the primary reasons that Alaska first embraced the Coastal Management Program, including state and local control over projects requiring a federal authorization, and state and local influence on direct federal activities. During discussions of the original bill on the House side, the administration took to heart some of the comments heard from the districts and from citizens in the districts. As a result, this committee substitute returns to the basic structure of the existing Coastal Management Program. It retains the existing four coastal resource service areas, all of which are located in the unorganized borough in western Alaska. And all existing coastal districts continue, and they retain the same authorities and responsibilities as under the current program. This CS also retains local enforceable policies and all the statewide standards of the program, including the habitat standard and the subsistence standard. Furthermore, it ensures that all federal activities, activities requiring a federal permit, or an activity requiring a state permit will have a consistency review. In other words, district enforceable policies remain applicable to all projects that are subject to a consistency review, not just the Outer Continental OCS, Outer Continental Shelf projects, and federal activities that were envisioned in the original 143. And the CS ensures that the districts will retain their seat at the table as project decisions are made. However, the committee substitute does make very significant changes to the program. It attempts to retain some important elements while addressing the problems which I've just mentioned. For instance, this CS eliminates the Coastal Policy Council and transfers its duties to the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. It also places a sunset provision on the current statewide standards and coastal district plans and mandates their replacement standards be clear, concise, not susceptible to subjective interpretation, and not duplicative of otherwise existing requirements. The CS also clarifies that local enforceable policies may not address a matter that is regulated or authorized by state or federal law, unless the policy relates specifically to a matter of local concern. And there is a test embedded in the statute that will assist the commissioner in making and the districts in making that determination. Furthermore, this legislation provides important clarifications on the consistency review process in order to ensure more predictable timelines and standards, including the scope of the project of a project that is subject to review and when a project can proceed in phases. It also encourages expanding the use of general permits. Finally, the CS clarifies that the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, DEC, permits and authorizations will constitute the consistency determination for activities regulated by DEC air, land, and water quality standards. And it insulates the ACMP consistency review from delays associated with these rather complex permits and authorizations, things like the air permits and contingency spill plans. Mr. Chairman, that, frankly, is my very brief overview. It is a very complex program. If you wanted the Department of Law to walk you through the significant sectional elements of the CS, we could do that, but I know time is tight, and it is all written down for you.
Okay, yeah, we do have those copies, and would the Department of Law be able to come back Friday?
We will be available, yes, for questions.
Teleconference?
Might have to be on teleconference. We also, Mr. Chairman, we are available to answer questions as they arise if the committee wants to.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for, I know it's a long subject and a lot to cover. I appreciate your brevity, and again, I apologize for...
That's all right.
As late as this meeting got started. Senator Lincoln has a question.
Can I request a copy of your testimony? Because it was very thorough.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. What I'd like to do is try to get to people that have signed up in Juneau that can't be here Friday. Is there anybody here? Oh, yes, sir. Come on up. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ken Donikowski. I'm the manager for ConocoPhillips that's responsible for our permitting in the state of Alaska. ConocoPhillips is the largest producer of oil in the state. It is also the largest leaseholder in the state, and we are the most aggressive explorer in the state of Alaska. And as such, permit streamlining is imperative for us to maintain this enviable position in the state, as well as encouraging other oil and gas firms to elevate their respective standing in these three areas. Consequently, ConocoPhillips unequivocally supports AOGA's position, to be presented later, on the CS before the committee. In closing, I offer two brief observations. First, this committee substitute preserves a role for the coastal districts and, in fact, formally introduces into the statutory language for the first time the concept of enforceable policies. Secondly, the regulatory framework for environmental protection in the state is preserved by this committee substitute. In essence, they remain in whole and in part intact. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Ullman?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your testimony. I appreciate it. You've certainly got as much at stake as anybody here. One of the things that I think has confused some of the coastal districts, and you brought it up in your testimony, is that saying that it empowers coastal districts because for the first time it introduces the concept of enforceable policies. And I'd be interested in what your definition of that is, because I know there is an awful lot of confusion from the people from the coastal district side who are talking about that who don't know what it is and don't know what the changes are when it comes to enforceable policies.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, enforceable policies, in my understanding, are policies that, according to the criteria laid out in the statute, are issues of importance to the local concern that do not duplicate the regulatory framework.
Is that, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, is that section 4650.070, is that what you're referring to?
Through through the chair, I don't have that CS directly in front of me, and so I can't comment.
Maybe the department can get back to me and see.
I would think so.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? I'd just like to, as resources chairman, I think I can speak on behalf of the legislature, that we really appreciate your aggressive posture that you've gotten to state as far as getting after it, and certainly the cutting edge technology that I think you could probably export around the world. I think Alaska's the leader in environmentally sound and doing it right technology, and so my hat's off to you and you guys, and encourage wish you good luck for not only your sake but the state of Alaska's as well. So we're glad we had you up here. Thank you. Okay, is there anybody else in Juneau that won't be able to attend Friday? Judy Brady? Okay. All right. I know you're in from out of town. Anybody else? Hearing none. Let's work through the list. About at the Anchorage LIOs, or anyone that has some, actually we'll probably be able to get through this. We've got about 35 minutes left, so there's six. There's nine people left to testify, so if we keep it within 2 or 3 minutes, I think we can get through everybody today that has showed up to the LAO. So let's go to Anchorage, Larry Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Howell. I am the general manager of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, more widely known as the Alliance. The Alliance is a nonprofit statewide trade association with chapters in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kenai. The Alliance is comprised of over 420 member companies that drive their livelihood from Alaska's oil and gas industry. If you looked at the workforce employed by our contractor companies, we would represent between 20 and 25,000 Alaska residents. The Coastal Management Program, the Alaska Coastal Management Program, includes the Coastal Consistency Review Process, which requires all projects located in the coastal zone to obtain a consistency determination before state or federal permits can be issued. Nearly all oil and gas exploration, development, expansion, and routine operations and maintenance activities undergo the consistency review process. The purpose of the consistency review process is to assure that projects within the coastal zone are consistent with state of Alaska and local coastal district enforceable policies. Funding for exploration and development in Alaska faces increasing competition on a worldwide scale. Many competing projects are closer to market and they are less capital intensive than equivalent production from Alaska. Before making investment decisions, operators need reliable predictions and permitting schedules and requirements. Delays and the lack of the permit timeline certainly are significant factors which can adversely affect the economic viability of a project. Because the ACMP is integral to the permitting system for oil and gas operations in the coastal zone, the ACMP is critical to the efficiency of oil and gas operations. The contracting community in Alaska is concerned with a lack of schedule certainty, the lack of scope certainty, and the unpredictability and subjective nature of the overall review process that exists today in the program. The delays in the issuance of permits, the unpredictable timelines, the lack of standards that eliminate certainty that is needed for developers to make capital commitments on future projects. Without going into the key components of the substitute bill, CS 130-143, we would just like to say that we endorse the new bill. We believe that it will streamline and improve the predictability of the current ACMP review process, and that these regulatory changes will benefit not only users of the coastal zone, both private and public entities. So speaking on behalf of the 420 members that make up the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, we encourage the Senate Resources Committee to move the bill out for action by full Senate. And I would answer any questions, Mr. Chairman, if necessary.
Thank you, Jay. Any of the committee members have any questions? Hearing none. And if anybody is abbreviating their testimony and would like to come back and get another bite of the apple, Friday, I'll have some latitude with that. Bob Stinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Stinson. I'm the president of ConAmp Construction Company in Anchorage. And over the past 18 years, my company has performed a variety of construction and maintenance projects throughout the state for an equally varied number of industries and clients, from building oil and gas facilities in Prudhoe Bay to remodeling homes in rural Alaska. I would like to say that I'm in support of the bill before you or any other form of the bill that changes the current process for procuring permits for development projects in Alaska. The current Alaska Coastal Management Program is unclear in its process and rules and needs to be fixed so that an applicant with a beneficial project knows what to expect when submitting an application to the state. I was also on the governor's DNR transition team and listened to large corporations and the local small companies who expressed frustration with the confusing and unpredictable AC&P review process. Our transition team recommended streamlining Alaska's complex permitting process, of which the AC&P is a major component. I also have firsthand experience with the current process and would like to describe a few problems I encountered. My company was hired by Anchorage Fueling and Service Company, a consortium of 22 major airlines, to replace a small aging pipeline routed through the Anchorage's residential street that delivered most of the jet fuel to the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. We were hired to design, build, and acquire the permits for a new, larger pipeline that would reliably meet the increasing demand. We submitted our permit application to the state, the Corps of Engineers, and the municipality of Anchorage. After preliminary discussion with each entity, revealed the soundness of our project and in particular the routing of the new pipeline. The project quickly became a target for environmental concerns as the routing took the new pipeline through portions of the Anchorage coastal mudflats. Throughout the next year and a half, we spent an extra $1.5 million securing the permit due to delays in the AC&P process. The project was originally estimated at $6 million. One of the most frustrating aspects was, in fact, there was no process. The Division of Governmental Coordination really didn't know how to handle our application, how to coordinate with the other agencies and the public. And in short, I had to hire many consultants to help invent our own process for permit review and coordination, all at the expense of my client. Specifically, there was no clear timetable or time limitations for review of the permit, no clear elevation process, phasing of the project was not allowed, all individual agency permits had to be complete before a consistency determination could be issued, and there was no scope of review to which anyone could work to. Without going into further detail, for which I would be glad to answer questions, I'd like to summarize by saying that this project was not a resource extraction project like mining or oil and gas. It was an infrastructure improvement project for the airport. If the state of Alaska had owned the old pipeline that needed replacing, the permit would have been issued in a totally different and expeditious way, allowing the airport to meet its growing demand for fuel. Needless to say, in the end, the airlines who experienced this permitting nightmare couldn't understand why our state was not supportive of a clearly beneficial project and talked about taking their business elsewhere. I encourage the Senate Resources Committee to move this bill out. I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Bob. And if anybody has any written testimony they'd like to submit, it helps our secretary transcribe onto the record, and we'll make it available to the members as well. Is there any questions, Mr. Stinson? Hearing none. I'd like to go off net now to Chuck Degnan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our Coastal Resource Service area was very concerned about this bill originally when it eliminated Coastal Resource Service areas. The other concern now that we have is the sunset provision for making new plants. The rural areas have clean air, clean water, and clean land, because there's not much development in the coastal resource service areas. But development that comes through takes such a long time that everything that's set up is planned out and the projects flow, and very few projects are delayed.
Mr. Degnan?
Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill.
Thank you, sir. And are you associated with one of the coastal zone management groups, or?
Yes, Bering Straits Coastal Resource Service Area.
Okay. And where are you calling from?
Unalakleet, Alaska.
Thank you very much. Next, let's go off net to Dan Bevington. And if you could state where you're from and if you're with anybody.
This is Dan Bevington. I'm the Coastal District Coordinator for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. And first, I'd like to thank the committee for this opportunity to express our that perspective from the Coastal Management Program of the borough. And we're also thankful for the Governor's Office to develop a bill aimed at improving permitting processes in the state. We recognize that this is a challenging, difficult task, and we've offered our analysis in order that you would know our perspective. The Kenai Peninsula Borough has more than two decades of support of its own program. Over that time, we've passed more than 34 ordinances and 7 resolutions that directly or indirectly support the coastal management program. I'll just move on here. The legislation asserts that the local government should exert its own coastal management control through planning and zoning powers. And from my view, at this point, that seems to be to add a level of complexity when the borough doesn't need to assert any more permitting powers through its participation in the program. We do appreciate the fact that the current working draft addresses some of that and allows us that opportunity. We're still concerned about the loss of some of our policies under the provision that DEC will have the exclusive determination of consistency of the program under its authorities. So. And we're also very concerned about the summary discharge of this of the Alaska Coastal Policy Council without developing a similar representative body within DNR, at least some ability to have some ongoing dialogue in terms of the development and maintenance of the Alaska Coastal Management Program. So this issue of promoting economic development while balancing these interests with the long-term community interest of resource management is a complex subject, and it really does demand a meaningful involvement of communities across the state of Alaska, including the local districts. And the state will give the local governing bodies the opportunity to participate in that. And that would be the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dan. Next, we have, any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Gary Carlson with Forest Oil. You on there, Gary?
I am. Thanks, committee, for an opportunity to provide some input. Again, my name is Gary Carlson, Senior Vice President of Forest Oil and a member of AOCA. And first off, I would say we support AOGA's position and testimony, but I would like to add some comments separately. The ACMP process, as it has been applied in Alaska, has become a regulatory maze and costly to the state and industry to administer. Its ambiguities and uncertainties provide a breeding ground for extractionists and special interest litigants to discourage and delay responsible development. There are several examples of this abusive practice throughout the state under the current program, including Forest Oil's recent investments in the Cook Inlet. which resulted in $1 million of value being destroyed without the benefit to responsible stakeholders or to the environment. This process is continuing as we speak. The legislation will make substantial improvements to the process by establishing a definite deadline to complete review under the ACMP, eliminating duplication of state and federal law by enforceable policies, establishing a bright line as to when the ACMP applies and when it does not, eliminating delays and consistency determinations while waiting on DEC permits, and requires the state and local ACMP standards to be clear, precise, understandable, and not subject to multiple subjective interpretations. This should improve the efficiency in the permitting process and, in doing so, reduce litigation exposure for the state and the industry. This bill gets us out of the starting blocks and making improvements to the overall permitting process in Alaska and provides a direction for further progress, and we support the legislation and support the concept of moving it out of committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. Mr. Chairman, I'm willing to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Carlson? No questions. Thank you for your testimony. Next person we have online is from Valdez, Lisa Von Bargen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I don't have any testimony today other than to say, again, as I indicated earlier at a previous hearing, that the City of Valdez and the Coastal District here is very pleased with DNR and administration's efforts to listen to the concerns that the Coastal District had about participation at a level playing field as the permits are being reviewed for consistency, and we really appreciate their including our needs and our ability to participate in this rework in the committee substitute of the bill. And that concludes my testimony today.
Thank you very much. Any questions? No questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Bob Shavelson from Cook Inlet Keeper and Homer. You on there, Bob?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, members of the committee. My name is Bob Shavelson. I'm the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper. I'm speaking here today on behalf of our over 500 members throughout South Central Alaska. I have a couple points I'd like to raise regarding this legislation. One, I heard Ms. Rutherford say at the beginning of the hearing here that the districts would retain their same authorities. And I don't know if I'm reading the same bill as Ms. Rutherford, but Section 14 will clearly eliminate a vast extent of local district authorities. And in fact, in my opinion, it'll be virtually impossible for local coastal districts to have policies that will meet the convoluted and legalistic language in Section 14 of the bill. One suggestion I had to the House Resources Committee is that we see some examples from the administration of what acceptable local enforceable policies would look like. And another suggestion would be to see a markup of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Coastal Management enforceable policies and exactly which of those policies would be retained under this legislation. My belief is that few or none of those policies would remain intact. My next point has to do with fiscal impacts. As you know, this bill carries a zero fiscal note. Yet it has taken this state government over 15 years to approve all the coastal management programs in the state. And there's going to be a considerable financial burden here to the state and also to the local communities, and what amounts essentially to an unfunded mandate, because we're requiring these local districts to now go back and completely rewrite these plans they've spent many years and many dollars to develop. Third point has to do with the administration timeline. I know that the administration gave to the House Resources Committee a packet of information that had a timeline, and one point I made there I'll make here is that that timeline does not include the process for an environmental impact statement under the National Environmental Policy Act. And Mr. Chairman, as you noted at the beginning of the hearing, this is an extensive policy change, and Ms. Rutherford also noted that deletion of the Coastal Policy Council and other significant changes, which in my opinion, in looking at the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act and its implementing regulations, will certainly require a very expensive and very time-consuming environmental impact statement for the entire state coastal program. A fourth point is that this will add complexity and confusion because as we take away local district authorities, we're also, and the administration has stated this, encouraging the adoption of local ordinances. So you won't have the one-stop permitting that we had seen in the Division of Governmental Coordination anymore. Instead, we'll see a more piecemeal approach where industry will have to not only get state permits, but they'll have to get local approvals too. And with that, I guess I'd like to make one comment regarding Mr. Carlson's testimony and his criticism of the Coastal Management Program.